This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, your dedicated Star Trek books and comics show here on the Trek FM network. I'm just one of your hosts, Dan Gunther, and joining me, as he does every week, is the man looking really good in his Mirror Universe leather uniform, Bruce Gibson. Bruce, how's it going today?
I'm really hot in the leather uniform, and it's hard when you have a itch to scratch through the leather. So,
oh, it's the worst.
Now I know
it?
Why the Mirror Universe counterparts are really ticked off all the time, because they can't scratch.
That makes sense. You know what? Headcanon accepted. That makes sense. I like that.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for a comic or a novel that talks about how the everybody's really itchy in the Mirror Universe.
Well, we are going to be talking about a comic today that has to do with the Mirror Universe. Unfortunately, I don't think that comes up, but everybody does look really angry. So in my mind, that's why they're angry now, though.
Right. Yes. It's like they live in Poison Ivy land.
Exactly. So for our feature today, we will be talking about the Star Trek The Next Generation novel, A Time to Be Born, which is the first novel of that epic 9-part novel series that came out a few years ago. But first, like I mentioned, we do have a comic to talk about in the news segment, and that is issue number 1 of the Star Trek Discovery Succession miniseries. So this is a comic that takes place entirely in the Mirror Universe, and with the exception of a little tiny bit of a prologue at the very beginning, it all takes place pretty much immediately after Discovery leaves the Mirror Universe towards the end of season 1 of Discovery. So, Bruce, kind of initial reactions. What did you think of this one?
Well, I mean, I enjoyed it, but I was thrown off at the beginning because it's like you just mentioned, when you open up the comic, there is a statement that says that the following takes place after the events of Star Trek Discovery season 1. After Discovery and its crew returned to the original timeline, this is what happened in the Mirror Universe after they left. And I was like, oh, this is so awesome. We're going to pick up right where in the Mirror Universe where Discovery left. And so It starts off with Mirror Burnham. And I was like, oh, she's alive. And then there's Lorca. I was like, wait. How can Lorca be that? Did he survive? I was all wait, what's going on? And then, but wasn't until I got to the third page, then it says, 1 year later, after the destruction of the Imperial flagship, I was like, oh, this is a flashback. But because the opening statement says this takes place immediately after, I'm expecting that first panel to be at that period.
Yeah, that was a bit ridiculous. That threw me off too, because, yeah, I was going through the same thing and I'm like, okay, that was not the best place for that little blurb then, because you immediately, it says what you will see next is immediately taking place after those episodes, and wait, no, it's not. What are you talking about?
Yeah,
and then we get into the meat of the comic and they follow that. Yeah, so that did bug me,
and they
too,
didn't really
sure.
need to have it there, because I mean, at least within the story, you wouldn't have been lost. You would have just started off maybe assuming that this is a, you know, prior to when Discovery comes to the Mirror Universe, because then when you get to the third page, it says 1 year later after the destruction of the flagship. So then you know where you are at that point.
Yeah, exactly. That blurb maybe should have been something a little more generic, like the Mirror Universe, a dark mirror of our own, where blah, 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 blah. You know, just kind of setting the mood instead of this weird expectation that's not exactly right.
Right. But I mean, that's not a huge complaint. It just threw me off. But outside of that, I mean, this is, you know, the first issue of a multi-part story. And I mean, I thought it started off really well because we are finding out the events of what happened and the universe is trying to figure out what they need to do next now that Giorgio, the Emperor, is gone or presumed dead. And so they have to reform the Empire, who's going to take over and such after that. So it's an interesting start to the storyline.
Yeah, I agree. I enjoyed this one. I think there's a lot going for it. The artwork, for one thing, is really great. And one of my favorite minor characters is Kayla Detmer, and we get a lot of her mirror counterpart in this one. So I really liked that. I thought that was cool. And the story itself is pretty interesting. So basically, we start by following the Shenzhou, and they're kind of coming across the remains of the Charon, which was destroyed by Discovery. And they're trying to figure out what happened. Apparently, there's one guy that they rescue that informs them of what went on and that the Emperor is dead and all that kind of stuff. And then we go back to Earth and we see this cousin of Emperor Georgiou kind of taking the throne. Before we get there, though, there's one really glaring thing that I had to go back and check because it really bugged me. And that's the character of Owoshikun. And I think I'm saying her name right. She was killed in the episode What's Past as Prologue. We see her vaporized on screen by Lorca. She's the Emperor's chief of security on the Charon. And all of a sudden, she's alive and well here on the Shenzhou.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And just to make sure, because I distinctly remember that scene where she comes out with her hands up and she's all sweaty and nervous and she says, you know, oh, blah, blah, blah. And then the Emperor's like, what are you doing here? And then poof, she gets vaporized. Oh, yeah. And I double checked on Memory Alpha. And absolutely, she was vaporized by Gabriel Lorca when he seized control of the Charon in the episode What's Past as Prologue. Underneath that, in Apocrypha, they have, in the Discovery comic series Succession, it was revealed that Owoshikun had somehow survived and was aboard the ISS Shenzhou.
But she was vaporized, right?
She was vaporized. So I think, I hate to say it, this is an out-and-out mistake by the writers of the comic, which is kind of unfortunate.
Oh, and, or the mistake of the show for killing her.
Well, I mean, I would tend in that direction too, because I really like the character and the actress who plays her. But then the comic goes and kills her just a few pages in later anyway, so.
She's like Kenny from South Park.
Exactly.
Kenny keeps showing up, it gets killed in every episode. That's going to happen here with Discovery.
Yep, I think that must be it, because it was a weird mistake to make, but I can't find any other explanation.
Okay, so here we go. This is going into Bruce's headcanon, trying to make it all work, okay?
Oh, boy.
No, this is going to work. This is going to work. So we're all right. She's never referred to in this comic by her first name, just her last name. So this could be her twin sister.
Okay, so it's not Joanne Owoshikun. It's...
it's...
Mary. Owoshikun. Yeah. Okay.
Or,
all right. Well,
you know, could be a cousin that, you know, they look similar. I don't know. I'm going with that. I'm going with that. Unless, you know, here we go. Unless there is a technology in the Mirror Universe that when you shoot, you have a certain gun that it looks like you're vaporizing someone, but all you're doing is really, it's almost like a transporter. It's like sending them somewhere in it.
It's called the "we've got a really cool character we want to use later, so we're gonna save them" gun.
But you know, okay, we shouldn't harp on it a lot, but it is interesting that they didn't pick up on that and they killed the character in the comic, that they didn't say, oh, wait a second, didn't we already see her get killed before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it, like I said, it just seems like an odd mistake to make. But, yeah, I don't know. But anyway, that aside, getting into the story, I find this story really interesting. This character of Alexander, who takes the throne, he's not anybody from Star Trek that we know elsewhere.
Not that I could think of. I was wondering the same thing, because just about every character in this comic is someone we've known before or seen before, and I don't recall this one being from anything that we've read or seen before. And it's not Alexander, yeah, like Worf's son Alexander either. So
no, yeah. or the short guy from the TOS episode whose name I can't remember at the moment. Plato's stepchildren. That's
the
one.
Yeah. I just saw that actually the other day.
I'm so sorry.
It was on the rotation on Netflix when I had playing in the background.
Nice. So this character, Alexander, do you think that Tom Hiddleston would be perfect to play him based on how he looks in here? Because I was thinking Loki on some of those close-ups of his
face. I can see that. Yes, I see what you're saying. Which is odd that you said that, and I didn't relate him to this character, but I kept thinking the character somewhat looks familiar to me, so maybe they did use him as a model.
That could be, yeah.
Like in, not directly, but indirectly.
So we also kind of get to see some of the other rebels as well. Basically, we're getting all of the reactions to the news that Georgiou is dead. And of course, when there's a power vacuum or when there's a transition of power, that's always the time that a government or a country is most vulnerable. So we see the rebels reacting to that. And we see the Mirror Laurel, which is kind of cool, and her reaction to the loss of Voke and all of that sort of thing. So the pieces are kind of getting put into place here. And there's kind of a surprise member of the rebels as well, which is who is Sarek's wife, Amanda, which was a neat addition as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that part of it was the most interesting to me, just to see Laurel leading the rebels in place of Voke and seeing Amanda Grayson there and just forming that team. Like, this is the chance now that the Emperor is dead, or they think she's dead. Now there's chaos in the Empire that if you're going to do anything, this is the time to do it, and that's now. And they're not the only group that is taking advantage of this opportunity, too. There's there's people within the Empire that are looking to take an opportunity to make things right in their minds. So it's going to start to get crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we meet a few of those characters, and they're kind of loyalists to Lorca. They were kind of his people before he died. And one of them, who is really cool to see in comics, and I think they got her look perfect, was in our universe, Admiral Cornwell. And here I think she's a commander, if I'm not mistaken. And so we get to see those elements kind of all falling into place as well. And then back on the Shenzhou, there's another kind of power struggle as well, which was really surprising. And this is where not only, as we mentioned, Owoshikun dies, but the entire bridge crew of the Shenzhou, save for one person, is all killed. Unfortunately, because of my admiration and like of Kayla Detmer. But yeah, they're all wiped out. And the one left standing is probably the bridge crew member that we see on Discovery in the Prime Universe that we know the least about, that I'm most curious about. And that's Commander and now Captain Arium.
Yeah, I almost had to go back and see how she killed everyone, because everyone on the bridge starts choking and falling down. And I was like, you know, somebody doing a Jedi choke hold or something? What's happening here? And I see her walking, and then I had to go back and look at a previous panel and notice that she had put a shield down over her face. So obviously there's some kind of gas that's been released, a poison toxin on the bridge, and she was protected from it, with that face mask or glass that's covered her face to protect herself from that. Yeah. And now, yeah, she's now the captain of the Shenzhou.
Yeah. And those of you who aren't sure who Commander Arium is, or Captain Arium, I guess, she's the kind of bionic person that we see occasionally in Discovery. She doesn't get a lot of lines, but I think she's a lieutenant commander in our universe and has command of the bridge a couple times. She's, you know, one of those bridge officers that I hope we'll learn a lot more about next season.
You know, that's one of the things, and it's hard to do this while you're in production on a show, because you want to kind of keep things open to explore these different characters if the opportunity arises. But it's like, I would almost wish they would say, you know what, these are minor characters on Discovery. We're probably not going to explore them much. Let's go ahead and start exploring them in the books. Because I would love to have an Arium comic or novel that's just all about her character, the history of her, and why she is like bionic, and you know, because she's apparently half human, half bionics, or whatever. You know, I'd love to know that backstory, and I don't know if we'll really ever get that in Discovery. We might have to wait till the whole series is completed before they would even go there.
Yeah, I don't know. That's one thing that I liked in the last few episodes of the season was they included them a little bit more. And I think that was kind of on purpose, because Lorca was such a control freak and didn't really get the input of his bridge officers. And later on that changes. But yeah, I would have liked to have seen more exploration. And like you said, the books and the comics are the perfect place to do that. And Star Trek has done that before. Like the Kelvin timeline, we get like the backstory of Scotty's little engineer helper friend, played by Deep Roy in the movies, whose name I can't remember at the moment.
Kinzer. Yes.
and the like android science officer 0159 or whatever his name was. But you know, so they did that with the Kelvin timeline characters. So something similar like that for the Discovery, you know, quote unquote minor characters would be kind of welcome as well.
I really wish they would go there, but again, I think they want to keep that open in case they want to explore them more on the show. So
yeah, probably.
Oh, well. But we do see another character from our Prime universe in the Mirror universe that we didn't see before, and it's Harry Mudd.
Someone who, you know, we know, of course, is a very big-hearted person who looks after refugees and cares for young children and is just an all-around stand-up guy by the looks of it. Wait, what?
Wait, this has got to...
Oh, right, Mirror Universe.
Yeah, it's
got to
be the Mirror Universe. That doesn't sound like the Harry Mudd I know.
Yeah, definitely. And then through this character, we get kind of surprise ending, which I think that's the one thing I'm not going to spoil here. If you haven't picked this up, you should pick it up. It's a really good read, and there's a surprise at the end that some people may have seen coming, but I think is pretty well executed.
I will give you the last word of the comic. Continued.
Ooh.
And before that's to be.
Yeah.
So that doesn't give anything away. But yes, the story will continue into the next issue.
Excellent. Yeah. So I recommend this one. I think it's a good good start to this comic. Like I said, I think the pieces are all being put into place for some really interesting things to happen. And I can't wait to see where it goes.
Yeah, and it definitely fills the void. I mean, we're waiting for season two, and I'm really enjoying these comics. It's really filling the void. I don't feel like Discovery's over. I'm just getting it in a different format right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm right there with you. And there will be, I think this is a 4-comic miniseries.
I think so. I think
right?
The last issue is scheduled for July, is what I read.
Okay. So yeah, we've got 3 more issues of this coming. Plus we've got James Swallow's novel Fear Itself coming later in the year as well. So there'll be a little bit more Discovery to tide us over. And then whatever else might still be in the pipeline. That
we should cover those on Literary Treks. How's that?
That's a good idea. You know what? I'm going to write that down because that's officer thinking right there.
Yeah, don't let me forget.
Excellent. Well, what do you say we jump on over to the feature and talk about a TNG novel?
Yes, I'm excited.
So today we're talking about a novel that was released in 2004, and it's the first novel of a 9-part series, and this was a Time To series. The first novel is A Time To Be Born by John Vornholt. And the way this series was set up is it's basically a series of duologies, culminating in the 9th novel by Keith R.A. DeCandido that kind of ties up the whole series. And so these first two novels, A Time To Be Born and A Time To Die, today we're talking about the first one, A Time To Be Born, like I mentioned. And these take place between the films Star Trek Insurrection and Star Trek Nemesis. And it kind of is setting up the status quo as we see in Star Trek Nemesis by the time these books are all done. So first of all, Bruce, I want to ask, have you read this before? Is this your first time? And how did you read it?
This is the second time I've read this book. The first time I read it was 4 years ago. And I read it on my Kindle. So I read the first two, A Time to Be Born and A Time to Die. And then I was going to read all the others and didn't get around to them. As a matter of fact, there was a group on Goodreads that was starting to read them, and they kind of trickled off. Hmm. And I don't even think they got back into it. And I was going to read it with the group, and it just didn't happen. So this is a perfect opportunity to do it. And I don't know why I didn't read these when they came out in 2004. Who knows what was going on in my life? I have no idea. But I'm glad that we're actually venturing into these now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I actually did pick these up when they were first published. And I did read, I think it was the first 4 novels of this series that I read back when they first came out. And I picked up most of them. I have most of them in paperback. And then this novel, you could actually point to it as the reason I started my novel review website, as kind of a way to remember the novels that I'd read, because I know I had read this one and I could not remember a thing about it. So I thought, I'm going to start a website and keep track of my thoughts on all these novels. And then at one point in 2013, I was like, I'm going to read the entire Time To series, start to finish, and really do it. So I read it a second time then. And that time I only got as far as A Time To Be Born and A Time To Die. And then I stopped. So this is my third time reading this novel. And, you know, third time's the charm. Maybe we'll make it, I'll make it all the way through the series this time. But yeah, so I feel like I've read this one quite a bit.
You should know this inside and out. I mean, I'm relying on you, Dan, to talk us through this whole novel.
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, it doesn't bode well that the first time I read it, I remembered nothing, like absolutely nothing about it. And the second time I read it, I kind of vaguely was like, oh, okay, yeah, I kind of, okay. So, but yeah, I should know it by now, right? I mean,
yeah, but you know, that's how it was for me. So I just read it 4 years ago. I had to look it up on Goodreads because I was tracking it then, but I thought it was just 2 years ago when I read it. I hadn't realized it'd been that long, 4 years ago that I read it. And there was things that I remembered about the book. I'll kind of save it for a little later as to what it is that really stood out to me that I remembered about the book. But there's other elements of it that I was like, I do not remember this at all, you know? But yeah, I'll reveal what it is that really stood out to me, because it's one of my favorite aspects of this book and the next one.
Okay. Excellent.
Got a little surprise there for you.
Excellent. Well, so the book starts out with kind of this unknown person. We're not sure who it is on this planet with this woman, and they're evacuating. This planet's kind of a casualty of the Dominion War, and it's been laid waste and barren. And this young man has to, you know, basically convinces this woman to evacuate. And we eventually find out that this person is Wesley Crusher, and he's kind of nearing the completion of his training as a traveler. And as part of that, he sees a vision of the future in which the Enterprise is destroyed with all hands aboard. And of course, this is horrible for Wesley because one of the lessons he has to learn is that as a traveler, he will have to simply observe and kind of bear witness to events in the galaxy rather than interfering and, you know, taking part in them. And of course, it's something he really can't live with. This book, it's kind of just introducing everything, and the story doesn't wrap up, and we'll see more payoff in the second book. But just to start out with, kind of reading this first bit and seeing that Wesley was going to be a part of this book, what did you think of bringing that character back in?
You know, I don't recall the first time I read this if I knew Wesley was a big part of this book or not. I think maybe I did, and I was looking forward to it because I was just curious to know what they're going to do with the Wesley character. Because, you know, we all know that there's a love-hate relationship with Wesley. Probably there's, you know, especially in the earlier seasons of TNG, there was probably more people that didn't care for Wesley, and then there's other people that love Wesley. Wesley was never a favorite character of mine. I never hated Wesley. He just, you know, he wasn't anybody that I got excited about. I remember when TNG was first airing, and as Wesley got older and he was going away to the Academy, I liked Wesley better as an older character than his younger self of saving the ship every episode, especially that first season. Mm-hmm. But then going into this novel, knowing that he's older and he's with the Traveler, I was very curious to see where this would go. So I was very open to that, but I was also kind of surprised because I knew these books are kind of that filling that gap between Insurrection and First Contact. I'm sorry, Insurrection and Nemesis. And I just wouldn't think Wesley would have a big play in those stories. And I don't know what his play is through all these books, if he continues on through all of them or not, since I've only read the first two. So what did you think when you heard about Wesley being in this book?
Kind of, I was a little bit excited because, you know, a lot of, like, Star Trek authors kind of have a history of taking plot threads that have been abandoned, or not even abandoned, but just, you know, kind of out there in the universe, and tying them in and doing really interesting things with them. So, you know, if someone could do something interesting with Wesley as a traveler, like, that's cool. Like, I'm eager to see how that plays out. And the one thing about Nemesis is, even though his lines were cut from the final film, there are a couple shots in the finished film where you see Wesley is at Riker and Troy's wedding, and he's sitting there in a Starfleet uniform. So I was always kind of wondering, like, what's he doing there? Like, is he like a Q now and just shows up in a Starfleet uniform all the time? Or, you know, like, what's that about? And like you, I honestly don't know if this series answers that question, if it continues through. I've read the first four, and I only remember the first two, anything about them. So I'm not sure. But, you know, I'm interested to see if they do tackle that question, if they explain his presence in Nemesis.
Yeah.
You know, whether he's just masquerading as Ensign Brewster and is for some reason at the head table or what.
Yeah, and I have the novelization for Nemesis. I haven't read it, though, but I do have it on the shelf. And so I wonder if that's even in there. I may have peeked at one point just to see, but I don't recall. So, yeah, I'm curious to see if they address that also. And we also learned. So let me ask you real quick about the Traveler. And this is kind of staying on the whole subject of Wesley, too. I, you know, the Traveler, I always thought was, you know, pretty cool. You know, I didn't mind the Traveler storyline, but I've since learned, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like a lot of people don't like the Traveler.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I just recently online, I was reading something about Traveler, and there was it may have been in the Babel conference. I just remember like a few months ago, people were like, yeah, I never liked that episode of the Traveler, either one of the episodes. I never liked the Traveler. Da, da, da. I was like, I had no idea. That and maybe it's not that, maybe it was just that one group. I don't know, but I just wondered what you thought of the Traveler.
I guess I've always been pretty on the Traveler. Like, he's interesting, I guess. I think I always found it weird. There's kind of an old joke that when a character on Star Trek gets really annoying and you don't know what to do with them, you have them evolve to a higher plane of existence and leave. And, you know, I feel like it was
Kess
kind of...
or something on Voyager?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's not my opinion on any of those characters. That's just something funny that I read online, you know, but, you know, whatever. So I don't know. I was always kind of like, with how Wesley left and to join the Traveler. I honestly don't really know how I feel about that. I think also partially because it was so near the end of the Next Generation series, I knew they weren't going to do anything really interesting with it. It was just a way to like kind of send him on his way and have a last Wesley story. So I was a little annoyed about that. But as far as the Traveler in general, he's an interesting character. I'm glad Brent Spiner got the role playing Data instead of Eric Menyuk. I like him as an actor, but I really like Brent Spiner. So yeah. if the Traveler was a consolation prize to the actor, that's cool.
Yeah, I'm the same way. It wasn't like the Traveler was an outstanding character to me. What I really love about the Traveler is what he did with Wesley, what, you know, brings to the Wesley character. So The fact that we're early in the series and the Traveler appears and says, you know, Wesley has these great abilities and da-da-da, then it's like, okay, well, you know, we've been led to believe he's a prodigy and, you know, he's saving the ship and he seems to know more than, you know, the senior members of the crew. But it's like, okay, well, there is something special about him. It's also, It's almost like a mystic quality to this character. All of a sudden, Wesley became a little more interesting to me, but not really after we first met the Traveler, but especially by the time we got further in the series. And I think it was in season 7 where the Traveler returns and we find out these special things about Wesley and that he can be a Traveler too. And I thought that was really brilliant because now we know why Wesley was so good at everything, because there's just something special and different about him. And now he's going on this journey to this higher plane of existence. And I just really found that to be interesting. But then we didn't get to see that until now. So this is what I was saying about earlier. Wesley is my favorite part of this book.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because of what I just said, we're getting more of that in him.
Yeah. I think, I really like, and we're not getting into spoilers yet, but towards the end of the book, the role that Wesley is starting to play in the things that he does, I love that. I think that's really cool. And we'll talk about that when we give this, after we give the spoiler warning. But I really liked him in that part of the book and that aspect of it. So I'm on board. Wesley's a cool part of this book for sure.
Well, again, because I think with all the characters, we get, you know, a little bit of development with a few of our core characters, but we're really finding out more about Wesley than what we've seen anywhere else. I mean, we're getting almost like a Wesley 2.0, a different Wesley.
Yeah, for sure. Well, as I kind of hinted at, it's almost as if this novel is kind of split into two main parts. And in the first part of the story, the Enterprise is assigned to the Rashanar battle site, which is the site of the deadliest engagement of the Dominion War. And there's wrecks of thousands of ships here. There's basically, it's a graveyard where every ship that was involved, Federation member worlds, allies, Dominion allies like the Cardassians and the Breen, they all fought here to the last man. Like everybody killed everybody at this site. And there's no real explanation yet. It's a mystery that they have to deal with as to why that happened and why this was such a costly and deadly battle. And on top of that, you have all these hulks of wrecked ships, but you've also got these weird anomalies like random energy surges that are kicking debris around and making tons of hazards to navigation. There's this weird gravitational vortex at the center that's pulling everything in. There's an antimatter asteroid apparently floating around out there, and basically all these weird anomalies. And on top of that, you've got pirates and scavengers that are looting the wrecks and making off with technology and sometimes whole ships, stealing them to strip them for technology. And already in place here is the USS Juno under Captain Leeden, and they're tasked with recovering bodies is kind of their main goal here. And the Enterprise has now also been assigned there to conduct scientific experiments, perform guard duty for the Juno, and things like that. And on the face of it, we learn very quickly it's almost an impossible task. There's so many things going wrong and so many hazards here. And Picard and the Enterprise, in a few situations, find themselves almost overwhelmed and making blunders here and there, which they're not used to. Picard's not used to making blunders. He's one of Starfleet's best. And the kind of friction between him and Captain Leedon play a big part in this first part of the story.
I almost felt as if Captain Leedon was not really working with Picard. It just felt she was just, okay, Picard, here's the situation. Things are weird out here. Just kind of follow my lead. Don't go over there. Stay away from this and just, you know, be a good boy. And she just seemed too commanding of Picard, you know? And
a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that he's, you know, they're both captains, but he's obviously more senior because it's even mentioned that he's been, like, the longest serving captain in Starfleet. So, and it's the flagship, so it just seemed really odd. But then again, dealing with what she's been dealing with this whole time, she's seen some weird things, and things don't always make sense, and she's still trying to figure out a mystery while trying to accomplish their mission. And, you know, you don't need another starship coming in there and mucking things up. As a matter of fact, I think she was also hoping it was going to be someone else coming. Not anybody in particular, but more, I can't remember, was it more like a rescue vessel or something like that, that she didn't expect they would send the Enterprise? She was waiting for another type of vessel to help out.
Yeah, it's a tough situation because, and they do mention in the book that although Picard is the more senior captain, she does have tenure there, basically. Right. She's in operational command of the overall mission. But yeah, they get off on the wrong foot right away. I mean, Picard comes and says, here are my orders from Starfleet. We're to do this, 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 and this. And Captain Leedon's like, no, you're just going to fly protection for us because that's all you're going to be able to do. And, you know, like, there's no give and take. There's no working together. Like right. You said, it's just they bristle against each other right away. And it's unfortunate, you know. A lot of things go wrong, but you can't point to just one reason why they all went wrong. There's a failure of communication. There's failures on multiple levels from everyone involved, I think.
Well, and Picard doesn't really seem to be that annoyed by it. You know, it's not like he's trying to fight her. I think he is trying to work with her. And I feel like after a while, she maybe gains a little more respect for him. And maybe, I think she always respected him, but I think she just started to learn to just trust him more. And is like, okay, Picard, you're saying you need to do something. Okay, I'm okay with that. I'm with you, you know. So it wasn't like she was a jerk or anything, but she's being a captain. She's leading the whole charge out there.
Yeah, but at the same time, she's also very stressed. As Counselor Troy points out, they've been there a long time dealing with stuff that they shouldn't have to deal with, you know. So, you know, there's a lot of stress and a lot of pressure, I think, on them to get this done. And it's at several points in the novel, they say, like, there should be a task force out there doing this. It shouldn't just be these two ships and having to deal with all of this. So it's almost like they're being set up to fail a little bit. Not literally, but I think that Starfleet feels that, like, oh, we'll send our best. We'll send Captain Picard and the Enterprise, and he'll clean this whole thing up. It'll be fine. And that's not what the situation needs. The situation needs a lot more attention than just these two crews can give it, I think.
Yeah, I don't think Starfleet really understood what was going on out there. And I'm sure that they've been told things, but maybe they didn't quite believe it and they wanted Picard to take a look at it. But it's also coming off of the Dominion War. And of course, we haven't seen much of the Enterprise with the Dominion War because it was the Dominion War was fought on the Deep Space Nine TV series. And we've had a few novels that venture onto the Dominion War with the Enterprise E. But this is the after effect of the war. But what we come to learn, in a sense, the war is over, but there's still a war going on in this graveyard.
Mm-hmm. This is probably a good time to jump into spoilers, would you say?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk specifically, I think, going forward here about what that war is and what's going on here. So in this battle site I mentioned, you know, all this stuff is happening, all these weird anomalies, and several characters say this at a couple points where it does feel like the war is still happening here. Like, you'll be flying around what they call the Boneyard, this battle site, and all of a sudden, you know, a ship will send out a random energy arc and go flying over, and a Klingon bird of prey will split in two and fly that way, and it's really unpredictable, and all this stuff is going on. And there's also something at work here. There's a mysterious presence that we don't really understand what it is until much later in the novel, when Data actually sees what it is firsthand. But there's definitely a presence here that's continuing to muck things up, and might even, some characters speculate, have been responsible for the initial reason why everybody fought to the last chip here in the first place during the Dominion War.
There's also, there's a new Federation member that's...
Yeah, the Ontalians.
Right.
Who are, this falls within their space. They're kind of the closest planet. And a lot of the ships that were involved were their ships, I believe, and they're doing a lot of recovering and salvage work as well as chasing off pirates and scavengers. And they're a new Federation member. Admiral Ross at one point says that, you know, they're a fairly new member and one that they want to hold on to because the Dominion War brought a lot of people into the Federation who were under attack by the Dominion, and they don't want to lose these members. And, you know, basically the situation could spiral out of control and cause the Ontalians to turn against the Federation. And eventually just such a situation happens.
Yeah, it was a little interesting because I didn't feel like we really got to visit that race all that much to learn anything about them. And maybe, and I don't recall if that comes up more in the next book, and maybe they want to leave them a little more mysterious. There were times I was really getting them confused with these scavengers or whatever out there. I always had to wait. Who are we? Are these the scavengers, or are these the new Federation members? Oh, these are the new Federation. Like, I just had to keep reminding myself who was who in this. I don't know why, but it was a little confusing to me for a while.
Right. Yeah. So the Androssi.
Yes.
They're the ones. So kind of the first major blunder that happens is Picard, Data, and LaForge are exploring the hulk of a galaxy-class starship, and they dock the captain's yacht.
The Calypso. And
the Calypso, yeah, the replacement captain's yacht for the one lost in Insurrection, apparently. What happens is it ends up getting stolen out from under them by these Androssi, and Picard is incapacitated, and they make off with the captain's yacht, which is, you know, a pretty expensive, pretty advanced piece of Federation hardware to have, you know, let pirates make off with. So
yeah, and those pirates were very clever. They had it all planned out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, they bested Picard, LaForge, and Data as a team. Like, that's not many people can do that. And I think there were a few mistakes made. I think they've gotten a little complacent in their old age, maybe. But yeah, they make off with the captain's yacht, and Picard kind of has to answer for that a little bit. And at this point, it's more embarrassing than anything else. You know, the Federation flagship captain has been bested, but he's not, you know, it's not negligence. It's not anything more drastic than he's a little embarrassed and has to kind of make it right at this point.
Yeah, it wasn't like they were really messing a lot of things up. They were batting zero. I mean, there was just several things that were going on that they maybe just weren't expecting things to play out the way they were. And who knows, like you said, maybe because they were getting older, or maybe they just didn't believe this being a graveyard. Maybe they felt like it was a little safer than what they'd been led to believe. And I think that's why the other captain, Leedon was questioning Picard and trying to lead him because maybe she just had a sense that he wasn't really listening to her and maybe not really understanding. And it's almost like, you know, oh, does it almost sound like she's telling fairy tales of like this is some kind of haunted graveyard or something, whatever. But yeah, even when they our crew on the yacht captures the Androssi woman, that she's, you know, she's buckled down on some, she's locked up or whatever. But, you know, she had planned everything out, that she had a device that Picard got numb and just kind of collapsed and he couldn't move and stuff. And she just unhooked herself and got up and walked out. It was all part of the plan. Got rid of him, threw him in the corridor of the abandoned ship and took off in the yacht. Joyriding.
Yeah, it's I mean, you know, it's gone in 60 seconds. She's they steal the Federation hot rod and make off with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this is kind of the first stumble, and like I said, yeah, it's an embarrassment, but it's not career ending, as, you know, they fear that some of the other stuff that happens later might be. And basically what happens is Data witness, they're chasing pirates, and at some point Data and LaForge's ocular implants and the shuttle they're in get shut down by this effect generated by an enemy ship, they think, because they come across the stolen yacht, but they come across an exact duplicate of it as well.
There's two of them that they're seeing.
Yeah, and this is, they're identical by every meaning of the word. Like, there are scratches of paint on the hull that match both. Like, they're exactly identical. So, you know, they don't have an explanation for this at first, and then everything shuts down and Data finds himself floating in space, and what he witnesses is the Ontalian's flagship facing off against the yacht, and then the yacht fires a beam at the Ontalian ship and seems to scan it or something like that, and then turns into an exact replica of the Ontalian flagship, and then the actual Ontalian flagship is destroyed. So Data sees all this and then is rescued. And then back on the Enterprise, the Ontalian flagship is chasing them, and, you know, Picard and the crew are hailing the ship and they're getting no response, and they're closing to within range of this weapon that Data saw them use, this scanning beam or whatever it was. And Data is urging Picard, you have to destroy it. It's a duplicate. It's not the real ship. You have to destroy it. The Enterprise has never been in more danger than it's in now, I promise you. And Picard, of course, has worked with Data for many years, trusts him, and even asks him to turn off his emotion chip. And then, you know, are you absolutely sure? And he's like, yes, I'm not hysterical, I'm not yelling, we're in danger, you have to destroy the ship. So Picard orders the ship destroyed, and of course the Ontalians, they see the Federation flagship destroy their Ontalian flagship, that from their perspective they don't know that it's a duplicate. And Captain Leedon on the Juno is incensed, and there's a standoff, and the Ontalian ships surround the Juno, and then they go after the Enterprise, and Picard is holding back. He's holding fire. He's not, you know, he's just hailing them, trying to explain himself. Captain Leedon on the Juno fires back at the ship to, you know, save the Enterprise. And then they all blast the Juno and destroy it. And Picard goes, well, crap. So like in the space of a chapter in this novel, like everything goes to hell. Like it's bad. And Picard and the crew return, like they warp back to Starfleet headquarters. They say, okay, we got to get out of here. This is out of our control. Let's head back to Starfleet headquarters. And that kind of brings us to the second part of this novel.
Well, before where, we get, you know, to that, that's what, okay, I was just going to say. This was almost like a two-part novel. So what you just described, that's the first part. And, you know, if we ever go camping, Dan, I want you to tell me stories of Star Trek at the campfire. Because you're like,
I was worried, I was trying to get it, starting to get a little long-winded there.
You were going through it, and I was just like, oh, yeah, and then there was that, yeah. Like, it was all coming back to me, the whole story. I'm like, this is good. This is a great summary. But The one thing I wanted to mention real quick about Data in this part of the story is when he's floating out in space, he's deactivated, but he starts to reactivate after a while as he's floating in space. And he starts to have visions. He starts to have these of his memories of past life. Like, we actually see him relieving a memory of being in the Academy and other things and first joining the Enterprise. So I like that little bit of flashbacks that we got on Data at that point. At the same time, because we're viewing his memories with him as he's floating in space and seeing all these ships going around in like a whirlpool, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was a very interesting visual play for Data in that scene. So I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, that was a nice little bit of character work, I think. And any insight into Data's early life in Starfleet, I think, is really interesting, because this novel actually brought up something that I've always kind of wondered, like, what was Data like at the Academy? I can't imagine he would have had any trouble with any of the physical requirements and, you know, the learning stuff where he's sitting in a classroom taking tests. Like, he's just going to ace them all. He remembers every fact to which he's exposed. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that, like, the academy head is like, well, okay, we can waive those tests because you'll just pass them all and all that stuff. It's just a neat little bit of insight, I thought, for sure.
Yeah, and it made me think when they said they sometimes customize some of the tests based on the race, and I was thinking, like, Vulcans, you know, there's like a test about emotions. Well, if the Vulcans don't have emotions, you're not really going to test them on that. And that's, well, kind of the same with Data and among some other tests that maybe they should just abandon because he's just going to pass, or they already know what the results are going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So for the second part of the novel, the Enterprise gets back to Earth, and basically the Admiralty is kind of wondering, okay, what do we do? Like, this is all screwed up. The Ontalians are threatening to leave the Federation. What do we do about Picard? And he's going to be psychologically analyzed. He's undergoing mental health tests to see that he's still fit to command and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, will there be a trial? Will he be held possibly negligent in this affair? And memorials for the Juno crew. Like, I enjoyed this aspect of the novel because we see a lot of things happen on Star Trek to the crews and day-to-day, you know, happenings on the Enterprise and that kind of thing. But we don't often see the fallout and the, you know, what people back at command are dealing with regards to it, especially something, you know, this big, you know, like an inquiry into culpable negligence and all that kind of stuff. There's been a few times in Star Trek we see that, like court-martial in the original series and stuff like that. But, you know, it's just a kind of neat peek into the inner workings of Starfleet, especially like that meeting where all the admirals are gathered around and Nechayev is kind of going to bat for Picard, and Admiral Ross and Admiral Paris and all of them are like, well, we've got to get him back here and we've got to, you know, get him out of the command chair and see what's going on and save the Ontalian membership in the Federation and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I like the fact that even though they're investigating Picard, they kept referring to the fact that, you know, his stellar record, as if they weren't going to just get him on this one thing. Like, you know, if right. this one thing happened, there's a reason for it. And it's not just, oh, this guy messed up, let's throw him under the bus. It's, well, you know, he's been a captain for a long time. We trust him. He has a stellar record. We still have to investigate this. We still have to put him on trial. But more than likely, we are going to find in favor of him because of his record and the way what he's already explaining. We may believe it if he says it. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not one of these things where they just, you know, abandon everything they've known about Picard all these years and just, you know, believe that he's doing wrong. You know, it's almost a question of he's always done right. Can he really do wrong?
Yeah. I've got to also say, like, for what Picard goes through and what he sees and what he reacts to and how he handles it, like, he handles that a heck of a lot better than I would have. Like, so they get him, at Starfleet Health or whatever, Starfleet Medical, and he's undergoing psychiatric tests, and he's in this hollow room that, you know, hollow ward that he's staying in, being held there. And just the little mind games and stuff that they play with him a little bit, that would really annoy the heck out of me. Like, I would lose my temper pretty quickly, which would probably tell them a lot about my psyche and say that I'm not fit to command a starship like someone like Jean-Luc Picard would be. So maybe, I guess that's why I'm not him. But, you know, he puts up with a lot, I think. And he does it in a way that's very Picard-esque. If nothing else, the author of this novel, John Vornholt, captures Picard's voice the best of any of the characters in this novel, I think, because of his patience. And even when he is getting annoyed, because we do get his inner thoughts as well, he's still very diplomatic and very Picard-esque outwardly, which I really liked.
Yeah, it's not as if he's showing up here and he's like, damn it, that was a duplicate ship. I knew what I was doing. You know, he's not like that. It's very much of, okay, I know why I'm here. And I think he was given a heads up from Crusher, because she knew from mm-hmm. talking to the head of Starfleet Medical that he was going to go under this evaluation. So he's also trying to protect her and not giving away the fact that he knew that he was going under this testing once they reached Earth. But
right, because she was ordered not to breathe a word to him.
Right.
After which she immediately went to his quarters and
breathed.
Told him. And then they had a date.
Then they had a date, right. So,
no conflicts of interest there, no. though, at all.
But I think it's interesting how you were just describing that, because it does come across to me as if Picard is being his diplomatic self, that he's approaching this as if he does with any planet or race that he's encountering for the first time, or if there's any kind of dispute, and he's going in level-headed and just dealing with it. And this case, he can't blame them for what they're doing, because he did destroy a ship, and it was based on the recommendation of an officer and not based on any facts that he had in front of him. And so he went with it. And to prove the fact that he's not insane, and to prove that he hasn't lost it, he is going to remain cool and collective and just ride this out, and hopefully everything will work out. But at the same time, I think we've seen some indications, not a lot, but some indications in this book that he's even questioning if he should be ending his career soon. You know, he's been mm-hmm. on board for a long time. I don't think he seriously was thinking he would, but there were times where it's like, you know, I don't know, maybe. Not because of the results of what we're talking about, but early on in the novel, it's like, you know, I've been doing this a long time. Maybe it's, you know, what point do I step down? When do I throw in the towel and just say, you know, enough is enough? I've, you know, he's not even been offered promotions anymore, because everybody knows he's not going to take them. He's just always going to stay on as captain. And I think he's also writing this out with the counselor and going through this evaluation, because I think he's using it as an opportunity for himself to evaluate himself and where he's going and what he's doing. And maybe he's even mm-hmm. questioning himself, am I really even as fit in command as I used to be?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that come up with during his sessions with the counselor, and that's Counselor Colleen Cabot, who we kind of meet towards the end of this book. This is a character that I kept putting myself in Picard's shoes, and I would be really annoyed with this character, because it feels like she's being very patronizing to him. But at the same time, whenever he kind of pushes up against it, she kind of changes a little bit, and she says, hey, Captain, you're here. I'm here. We need to do this. Okay. And he's like, oh, right. Okay. And she kind of reverts back into, okay, now I'm your counselor again. So I'm like, okay, she's very professional. She's doing her job. And I really appreciate in those moments how she treats Picard. Anyway, that's just a little sidebar.
Yeah, I almost feel like there's a bit of a wink to each other between these two characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, at one point, I wondered if there was from her end a little even flirtatiousness about how she is with him, especially when she starts very early on asking why he never married. Because she comes to his room, which he has set up as a cabin. It's one of her programs. And so she's like, oh, you picked my log cabin. And she's like, would you have picked it if you hadn't known that this is my favorite or something? And she brings a picnic lunch, but they sit the table in the cabin and they're eating it. And, you know, they just start questioning. And she's like, why haven't you ever gotten married? And I don't feel like she was doing that because she was seeing, oh, is he available? But there was a part of it that I read as maybe being, you know, a little interested and being a little flirtatious and maybe even just doing that just to get him to respond to her and her questions. And she did go there with the idea of, is it because of the death of Jack Crusher that impacted you on never getting married? And his answer was yes. I mean, he didn't even have to think about it. It was like, you know, because of what happened to his best friend, he just really hasn't been able to entertain the idea of getting married, which is great because what we know coming up future novels, this is a good bridge of getting to that point.
Yeah, I really liked those insights. I thought those were really well done. It's, you know, we don't often see Picard being really vulnerable. And when we do, like there are times, but they're very notable occasions and, you know, with Counselor Troy or something like that, where he's revealing his feelings. So I really did appreciate those scenes where we get those insights. And like you mentioned here, the reason that he didn't marry, there are a number of reasons, but that was a big one. I thought was a really interesting insight, one that I hadn't thought of before. And I like that the novel goes there with him for sure.
Yeah, because when she suggests Jack Crusher, I almost expected him to say, no, I don't think so, or let me think. But he was very quick to say, yes, I think that is. But yeah, he seems to be a little more calm about this whole situation, you'd think. You'd think he'd be talking to his other crew members of like, okay, we have to somehow help me get out of this. I'm going to play coy and I'm going to go along with things, but I need you guys to work on some things on your end to get some information that we can reveal later and free me and everybody, and we're living happily ever after again. But he just seems to he's just going with the flow, and he doesn't really seem to be that annoyed by it or even that concerned.
Yeah, and I find it really interesting the deal that they're offered too, which was actually a very generous deal, which is if he pleads guilty to negligence and apologizes. Actually, it wouldn't even get to that point. He would just claim responsibility, say there was mistaken identity and friendly fire, and apologize to the Ontalians. Then the Ontalians would stay in the Federation and Picard would still be on the Enterprise and go off on their merry way, which is a very generous deal given what happened. But Picard is unwilling to do that because it's not the truth. The truth is there's a mimic ship because he trusts Data. He believes Data's report to be accurate. There's a mimic ship out there, and not only is his own reputation at stake, but the Rashinar battle site and whoever goes there to replace them afterwards, they're at stake as well. And they have to go back and solve that problem as well. So it's not just Picard's own reputation and feelings he's worried about. If that's all it was, he would probably be willing to say, okay, you know, that's fine. I'll take the blame. I know it's not true, but I'll take the blame and apologize and we'll move on. But he knows that there's more at stake than that.
Well, and also what's going on through this whole situation, and especially when the admirals are meeting and when they're questioning Picard on things, there's this Ensign Brewster there.
Mm-hmm.
And Ensign Brewster's even like giving nods to Picard, and people always, you know, sometimes look at this ensign and think, there's something about him that looks familiar. Even like a Geordi at one point, it's like, that Brewster guy seems familiar. But then as soon as Ensign Brewster leaves, people are like, wait, who was that ensign again? Was there an ensign here? Like, people start to forget about him and what he looked like. And basically what we come to find out, and we know about this all along, it's not revealed, but we know all along, this is Wesley. Wesley is observing all of this. But no one recognizes him. He's taking on a different look, or maybe he has the same look, but it's just he's messing with people's minds that they can't connect that it's Wesley. I just thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, this is what we were referring to earlier. This part and Wesley's role in it, I think, is really cool. I love that he just kind of shows up and is all of a sudden Admiral Nechayev's aide, kind of influencing her to just like, oh, okay, Ensign Brewster, that's your name. Okay, cool. Here, file these for me, blah, blah, blah. Like, he's just kind of trailing along behind the Admiral and learning what's going on and what's going to happen to Picard. And then he, you know, meets up with Geordi and frees Data from the lab that he's in because they have to attend the memorial and, you know, all this stuff. I really love this bit. I think it's really cool to see these characters through Wesley's eyes and not have them recognize that's who he is and that he's doing all these things. And we get a little bit of the indications of some of his abilities as a traveler too. So, for example, they're out in the rain and he produces an umbrella to hold over himself and Admiral Nechayev, but it's not really an umbrella. It's kind of him exerting his traveler powers to protect them from the rain in the form of something that looks like an umbrella or something like that. And it's just a neat way to write this character and kind of using his abilities very naturally, which I thought was kind of cool.
And there's something odd about this ensign because he'll do little things like walk up to Picard and say, it's going to be okay. You know, it's like, what kind of ensign just walks up to a captain that, you know, the captain doesn't know the ensign and just like, it's going to be okay, like pat on the head. And they just kind of accept it like, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's just something unique about this ensign. But then once they start thinking about him, then they kind of forget about him. It's almost like, wait, what was I just thinking about? Was there an ensign here? Wait, I don't even remember. What did he look like? I don't even remember. Like, they start to forget. Mm-hmm. And it's just very interesting how that plays out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really cool. And the fact that that it is Wesley Crusher, and we get basically the final bit of this book is Beverly Crusher is really missing Wesley. And, you know, he reveals himself to her at the end and says, I'm going to save the Enterprise, which is flying directly in the face of what he's learned as a traveler. But it seems like he's made that decision to kind of throw that away and throw his hat in with the Enterprise crew and save them. So, again, this is mostly set up for the next book, which will wrap up this duology. So, you know, this part of the 9-part series, but it's still a really interesting story and really good setup. You also have here in the notes a little bit more about Data. So because it was Data's report that made Picard take the actions that he did and possibly save the Enterprise, I think maybe they should be making a little bit more of a big deal about that. That, you know, what if they didn't do it and the Enterprise was destroyed 5 seconds later or something like that. But anyway, Starfleet decides to remove Data's emotion chip, which is pretty drastic, I think. But apparently the clause in the regulations that allows them to do that is it's add-on equipment, because when he joined Starfleet, it wasn't part of him. So under that authority, they're saying, well, you're not allowed to use that while on duty or something like that. We're taking it out. What did you think of that? That was... I was like, wow, when I read that.
It was a bit creepy because at this point, he's not using the emotion chip. So he doesn't have emotion about it. And Geordi's just like, Data, they're taking your emotion chip from you. I mean, you should be upset. I mean, Geordi's all upset about this whole thing. And Data's just matter of fact about it. He's like, oh, well, you know, when I joined Starfleet, that wasn't part of me. They have every right to take it. So, you know. It's almost like, you know, it's very logical. Like, that's the thing to do. And it's like, mm-hmm. they're taking your emotions away and you're just like, okay, yeah, they can. Here you go. No problems. Of course, the emotion chip isn't on while he's having those thoughts. But I think what made the emotion chip very interesting to me throughout this book is the play that Data has of turning it on and off at different times. So it's like when we talked about him floating in space, he's making calculated decisions on what he's going to do without the emotion chip. And then he gets to where he thinks he's made a decision, But then he turns on the emotion chip to make sure that he can make a final decision by saying, you know, well, where does intuition come, you know, come into play into my decision? Where does fear come into play in my decision? You know, it's really, you know, it's one thing to make the decision without emotions, but then to validate those decisions with emotions is the next step. So Data's always going back and forth with that. And then even when he's back on the Enterprise and the duplicate ship is about to attack, he's got his emotions on and he's like, we've got to shoot the ship. And Picard almost is doing the same thing. Well, that's the emotion side. But to double check things, let's turn it off and see what the results are. And the results were the same. Of course, the emotion wasn't there, but Data still had the same recommendation that the ship needs to be destroyed. It's a duplicate ship. So at that point, Picard realizes, okay, this isn't an emotional decision. This isn't Data, you know, reading into things about the ship and being emotional about it. This is also now logical, because the same conclusion that he is recommending to Picard is the same results without emotion. And so anyway, I'm going on about this because at this point, as Starfleet is about to take away his chip, they were even questioning Data earlier about how he obtained the emotion chip from Lore, and that Lore was making bad decisions. And they're like, okay, so you're relying on this chip that came from Lore that made bad decisions, and you're relying on this chip to make good decisions?
Yeah, it was very, very lawyerly.
Yes.
Which, anytime there's like a courtroom scene or, you know, a lawyer is kind of twisting things from their perspective, I always find that really frustrating. And I know that's how the game is played, but oh man, I just, you know, I kept coming up with different ways to throw it back in his face and reword what he was saying. But, you know, of course you can't really do that because a lawyer's trained to be able to outdo you on that. So, but, oh yeah, that was frustrating.
Yeah. And it really comes across to me in this book that it's really unfair that Data can turn emotions on and off. It's either you're all in or you're out, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that really came across in the novel that, you know, oh, really, how convenient for you to be able to just turn them off when you need to and then turn them back on. And that's really unfair to the rest of us that always have to deal with our emotions, and we have to deal with pain, and we have to deal with the consequences of all these things. And you take the cowardly way out and just boop, turn it off when you need to. And, you know, in a sense, it made me wonder if it's best that they do take the emotion chip away from him.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. What is best? And it almost does feel like that way sometimes. I'm just reminded of the very ending of the questioning of Data when the lawyer says, you know, feel free to turn the emotion chip off now. You're done if you want to be more efficient.
Yes.
And like, I was like, oh, you jerk.
Oh, that was a great line. I'm glad you brought that up. Yes. Oh, that piece right there. That's exactly it. I mean, it's like a slap in the face to all of us who all like Data and then realize like, yeah, how convenient for you. You know, it's like it really is unfair.
Yeah. Now there's a novel, and I think it's one we covered on the show, but I can't remember which one it was. Maybe we didn't, or maybe it was with Matt. I'm not sure. But it was Picard basically apologizes to Data for what he said in First Contact by telling him to turn off his emotion chip because he was like, I shouldn't have done that, Data, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they had this whole thing where I have no right to tell you when to use your emotion chip or not. And
that I do recall that. That is true. I don't remember what that's from. I don't know if that's from one of the later novels that, oh gosh, yeah, I don't know. Somebody just tell us in the Babel conference or send us an email, but I do remember that.
Yeah. So definitely one of our listeners has to know that for sure. So get in touch with us and let us know that, because that was bugging me while I was reading this too.
It must have been something we recently read, because we're both remembering.
I think
that
it must have been at least within the last year or so.
Yeah.
That's my guess. But yeah, I can't remember. Well, so with this first novel, A Time to Be Born, we're kicking off, like I said, a 9-part book series. It's going to be a big undertaking. Probably take us quite a while to get through them all, but really excited to do that. So this first part, Bruce, what are your kind of final thoughts on this story, and where do you kind of fall on a rating for this one?
Well, this novel is a little less than 300 pages, so it's a little shorter than most of the more recent Star Trek novels in the past decade or so. And I felt like it was very much a quick read. It flowed very well. I think probably this novel and the next novel together could make one nice sized novel as one. So it almost feels like maybe they took, you know, a novel and split it into two. But that's fine, because it's a great setup. It makes me very intrigued to see where the series is going. I'm hoping that the themes that have been introduced in this novel do carry through all the nine novels. Having not read all these novels, I don't know if this is just like a two-part story, and then when we get to the other novels, they really have nothing to do with this, and it's all just taking just novels dealing with the same, this time period in between these two movies. I would like to see somehow that these stories are all connected with what were introduced in this, especially with Wesley. Who would have known? I want a 9-part Wesley story. But now, and of course, I don't want it all to be about Wesley. I want to see other characters. I want to know what Guinan's doing. You know, what's happening with her? She's not even in this novel. So my favorite thing also, and you mentioned it earlier, I just love the way this novel ended. And this is exactly how you want to end a novel for the first novel of a series. And that's, you know, when Wesley is reunited with Dr. Crusher, his mother, and she's like, you know, so you know what happened with Picard, and, you know, why have you come back, Wesley? And yeah, that line you mentioned is to save the Enterprise. Boom. And it ended there. And I love that too, because it goes back to what I was saying earlier. Those early episodes of Wesley always saving the Enterprise. Here he goes again.
Yeah, exactly. I never thought of that, but that makes a lot of sense, you know, getting back to the character's roots. That's cool. Yeah, I really enjoyed this one as well. I feel like they got the characters really right. Like I mentioned, Picard especially. I think John Vornholt captures his voice really, really well. I also really liked the action in this novel, and I liked the pacing as well. A lot of times novels can kind of go in fits and starts, and there's kind of slow periods, but like everything I felt fit together really well here. The parts that take place in the Rashinar battle site, that place is chaotic and unpredictable, and I felt like, well, as I was reading that, I felt that as well. Like it felt very, anything could go wrong at any time, and everything is going wrong, and it's very chaotic, and I have no idea what's going to happen. So John Vornholt was really able to capture that mood really well. And then the second part where Picard and crew are back at Starfleet headquarters, I felt was really good too, because they were in an unpredictable situation there as well, but of a different sort. So having to deal with bureaucracy and that sort of thing. So I really enjoyed this novel. I would have to give it, like, it's not perfect, but I like the character exploration and the unexpected twists and turns, and it's a good setup for part two. So I'd say a pretty solid 3.5 to probably more on the 4 side. It's a good novel. I'd say 4 out of 5 gutted ambassador class starships drifting around a gravity whirlpool of some kind.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I agree with that rating. I'm about the same on that. I would say that the gravity generators on the ship are working really well.
Nice. That's a good rating. I like that.
Wesley has come through for us again. He's not only saving the ship, but he saved this novel. No, it wasn't just because of Wesley. The whole novel was good, like you were saying. I really enjoyed it, and I'm really anxious to get to the next one. And, you know, thank you, Matt Rushing, for your suggestion of doing this series, because, you know, we're not getting a lot of new novels so this year, so the perfect opportunity to do a 9-part series.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's an ambitious series. I think it was an ambitious series when it was written. Like, I feel like this was a big project, and I'm happy to finally be forced really to read all of them finally, because I've tried a few times, and that's not a comment on the quality of these books. I remember enjoying them, the ones that I'd read, but it's just, you know, sometimes it's hard to find the time to really dig in and commit to a series like this. So I'm looking forward to exploring them all. It's been, and I have to say, it's been a lot of fun talking about 9-part book series today, but it's not the only thing we've been discussing on the Trek FM network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Warp 5.
I guess I'm going to be the one dissenter because I saw major differences, maybe not in the way it was shot, but in the storylines. And I just thought, yeah, it's Klingon court, and that's pretty much where the similarities ended for me.
The 602 Club.
And I really love, before they go to detention, their principal, Bentley, saying, you know, you get one life, and you get to decide how you're going to spend it. And on top of that, Bravestone says to Finbar, he says, you know, it's a lot easier to be brave when you've got lives to spare. It's a lot harder when you only have one life. And Finbar's like, you've only ever had one life.
The Orb.
I felt like they found a reason for why Sisko would say, okay, I'll stay. Otherwise, you know, he immediately, at the beginning, was like, I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to get involved. Send me back to my universe. This is not my place.
Earl Grey.
Wesley and Patru pass by Worf's quarters where they hear screams coming from within. They find Worf is being beaten by Geordi, Tasha, and Data. There's more. Patru moves in to help, but Wesley stops him. He explains that this moment of humiliation is one celebrated by Klingons.
Okay.
So, and the script goes on to explain that Worf tearfully thanks Geordi, Tasha, and Data because being humiliated by friends makes it, quote, the finest humiliation he'd ever experienced.
Okay, I almost believe that, except the part that says Worf in tears.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts if you're an Apple user. And you can get it on your iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or even the desktop iTunes app, which I really like because I'm Apple TV. I will play our podcast sometimes when my wife walks in the room and she thinks that we're on TV briefly because she'll hear our voices on it. So, but that's where you can get all the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And while you're there, give us a star rating and written review. We haven't gotten one since February. Believe me, I look all the time because we will read them here at the end of the show. So send one in on iTunes and we'll read it in an upcoming episode. And if you're not an Apple user, that's okay. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
And if you'd like to play a role in helping us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon, and you can do that by visiting patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all of the details. Perks can include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. And those are all available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce and distribute these shows each month, and we really appreciate any support you can give us, and we really hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all of the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
And the cool thing about Patreon, too, is we do the roundtables, and I hosted a couple of them about a month or so ago. One was about the Kelvin timeline. The other was about the first season of Discovery. And I know Brandi Jackala did one about favorite episodes of Enterprise. And it's a great way to meet other Star Trek fans. So that is a big plus, just pushing that out there just because it's a lot of fun. That's how a lot of hosts on Trek FM got involved, was through that group. So
yeah, absolutely.
And of course we are always in the Babel Conference. That's where we talk about all our shows and our thoughts about Star Trek, and it's a very safe place in Facebook. It's called the Babel Conference, our listeners group, and just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook and should come right up. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that on the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send a show and select Literary Treks, and it will come right to us. And of course, we're on social media. You can go to Twitter, we're at TrekFM, and on Facebook, we're at facebook.com/TrekFM.
You know, Bruce, we read so many darn books for this show. I really wish there was somewhere that I could easily keep track of all of the books that I've read and all of the books that we have coming up on the show. Where could I find that?
Probably Goodreads, because I'm always updating it so you can keep track.
Goodreads, right. That thing that you always update and I never do anything with. I'm so sorry. But you can find us on our Goodreads group, where we have bookshelves with all of our previously covered books, as well as the currently reading section, so you know what's coming up for future shows. And there are great conversations happening about all of the books and comics there. Just search for Literary Treks on Goodreads and click Join Group, and one of us will let you right in. I'd also like to take this moment to thank Norman C. Lau, Ken Tripp, Greg Rozier, Brandon Chemutella, Justin Ozer, and Jeffrey Harlan for their support of the Trek FM network. And we'd really like to thank you for being associate producers for Literary Treks as well. Thank you guys so much. We really appreciate it. Now, Bruce, when you're not slowly circling a gravity well, hopping from debris to debris, trying to find your way out to report back about that weird mimic ship, where can we find you?
Well, once I land on your ship, you can also find me on Twitter at @Admiral_Rex. And you can find me talking Star Wars, especially Solo, a Star Wars story, on the Star Wars Report podcast. And you can find that wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, you'll always find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference. And Dan, when you're not portraying yourself as Enston Brewster and walking the halls of Starfleet disguised as not yourself, but as someone else, since you are a traveler, where can people find you?
You weren't supposed to know that was me, Bruce. I probably should have turned location services off on Twitter, but unfortunately I left them on, so you know it's me. I'm at Kertrats on Twitter. That's Kertrats. You can also find me on YouTube talking on my Star Trek channel at youtube.com/Kertrats Productions. I usually don't do that as Ensign Brewster, though. I just do that as myself. So you can recognize me and hit subscribe.
You're a YouTuber.
I am a YouTuber, I guess. Hey. leave some positive comments on there. I want some positive comments, by the way. So everyone listening, find my channel, leave a positive comment on a video, because I know Literary Treks listeners are just a cut above the average YouTube commenter.
Well, so, at least, you know, people should check it out just to see what you look like.
Yeah, there you go. I have a face made for podcasts, by the way. And, of course, you can also find me on facebook.com/Kertrats Productions and, like Bruce, in the Babel Conference, mostly lurking, sometimes commenting. Well, thank you everyone for listening, and until next time...
Live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.